But not this morning, because we have a guest. We have a great guest. Bill Shun. It's been a long, long time. Last time you were here, was that when you were, like, just before the Hugo, the Nebula?
It was probably just before the Nebulas, 2007.
That would be 2007.
Yeah.
Is that the last time you were here, 6 years ago? No.
That's I don't think I have been on the show since I moved to Chicago. And now I've moved back. And
to New York.
Back to New York.
It's about bleeping time is all we can say. You know that's a second city, right?
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. I'm not sure why it's this. I think it's because New York is... I think New York is the first city. Why? It's certainly the Windy City. You go down Michigan Avenue in the winter, try to stay on your feet. It really...
It does
lives
get
up
windy.
It.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
But why the second city?
I read something recently that talked about that. It really is in relation to New York and Chicago's second status and inferiority complex.
I think Brooklyn is the fourth.
It would be.
I believe Brooklyn is the fourth. It was 120 years ago, mm-hmm. the fourth largest city in the world, Brooklyn. It was not a part of New York New York City at the time, and was actually so big. That was the fourth largest city in the world. I think Chicago was larger. I think Chicago was already the second city because it's the railroad hub. Economically, it might have been bigger than New York. I'm not sure about that because we're not as major. Well, we have the oysters and the beavers.
But Chicago certainly could have been. Those stockyards in Chicago were something to see.
Oh, yeah. And I've actually attended a Microsoft party. In the stockyards, right behind the fabulous, what's the name of the art museum?
Institute.
The Art Institute, where the Georges Seurat paintings are and all that. Well, so right behind there are the railroad hubs and some of the stockyards. And they are something to behold. They really are.
They are.
But it's about bleeping time you're back here.
Well, thank you.
And Laura. Who isn't on our show.
But, yes, you know, my lovely wife, Laura Chavone.
Yes, but it's been way too long since we have seen her. But I mean, I we must have at least seen each other at a convention or
at least once a year we've seen each other, whether it's at the SFWA Authors and Editors Reception.
I'm always at that.
Yes, and I am too.
Yes, okay, so... That's probably what it is. But then I'm so busy handing out business cards and talking up this show and the reading series and all of that stuff that I'm in. And that party lasts like 4 hours, and I need about 10 for that party.
Yes.
Because I am in hyper mode as opposed to...
as opposed to your usual reticent self.
Yes, exactly. My usual laid back... kind of thing. So in all these years, what have you been doing with yourself? I've seen some novellas.
I've been doing a bit of writing. We moved to Chicago for my wife's work, more or less, and so that I could write full-time.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly that's worked.
Before that, you were a programmer.
Yes.
A computer programmer for such places as CTW?
Yes. The former Children's Television Workshop, now Sesame Workshop.
Oh, I didn't realize they had...
They rebranded themselves around the year 2000.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but going back even farther than that for WordPerfect, that was my first job out of college.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, WordPerfect in Utah.
In Utah.
Because you were Utahian, right?
I am a Utahn.
You are a Utahn. Ooh,
well,
that sounds
not anymore.
Skiffy, right?
It does. It sounds a little skiffy.
No, but you were an LDS Utahn.
Yes, I was.
Yes, this was, and if anybody wants the story on how he un-LDS'd, get those letters in the correct order. LDS.
Yes.
It's online in spoken word format, correct?
It is. You can go to my website, shun.net.
That's two N's.
Yes.
Three N's with a dot.
Right. That's an important distinction.
SHUNN dot N-E-T.
/podcast.
Ah, slash. Let them go to the portal.
Yes, you can find everything from there.
See what, you know, let them go to that. Find your fiction. Find your blog. What is the title of? Is it The Accidental?
Oh, the podcast memoir is called The Accidental Terrorist.
Right. Which I just don't understand why that has not sold as a book or even a movie. Like, it would be a great HBO movie.
You know, once upon a time, I was working on a screenplay with a couple of associates, and that may happen again.
It may still happen. Okay, yeah. It's a good enough story. And I dare say that the shenanigans of another LDS, very current vocal LDS science fiction writer, Mr. Card.
Oh, I thought you were referring to Mitt Romney for a second there.
No. Science, not fantasy writer, science fiction writer. Yes. There's also Mr. Brandon Card. Sanderson.
There is.
Is also LDS, but he does not let that interfere.
With his humanity?
Yes. With his humanity in his writing. Yeah, I used to like Scott.
I did, too. I met him a few times. I was friends with his brother when I lived in Utah.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
His younger brother, Arlen.
Yeah. You know, I had him on the air the day he won the Nebula Award. I know I've told you this 100 mm-hmm. times. The day he got the Nebula Award for Speaker for the Dead, which I still think is a wonderful, wonderful novel.
It is. It's a wonderful novel.
And let's separate everybody, the art from the artist.
I mean,
Wagner was an anti-Semite, and yes, in Act One of Siegfried, there's some very anti-Semitic things that don't have to be played that way.
Mm.
But I still enjoy and listen to Wagner. And I will be anxious to see Ender's Game.
I will as well.
Largely because of Holly... What's her last name? Stillwell? She's starring True Grit.
Steinfeld? Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's Steinfeld.
No, I don't think it's that Jewish.
Steinway,
no.
Someone can consult.
I've got my... I could look at IMDb, but no. But she's in Harrison Ford. I can't tell anything from the promos. They're too... not LDS, but ADD.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much cutting, and you can't tell anything from a trailer.
Right, right. I hope it's going to be a good movie.
But Scott Card is doing everything he can to sabotage. Not this film, because I don't think anybody is going to stay away from this film as a result of it. Although he was cut out of writing a Superman book.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. He was working on Superman, and he was told, we're going to use a different writer. And this was when he was still doing, if people don't know, Orson Scott Card is this really fine, great writer. Although, years and years ago on WBAI, Peter Lanborn Wilson, who did the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and was a fine science fiction writer under the secret pseudonym of Hakeem Bey, where he wrote The Autonomous Zone, T-A-Z. Actually, rather good book.
Mm.
And he edited a few science fiction anthologies and all that. And he was calling out Scott, and we're talking now about the 70s, okay? The late 70s, early 80s. And he was calling out Scott, saying, you know, there's a lot of issues with the way you treat boys in your book and pederasty, and there appears to be no small amount of homophobia. And Scott has been spending some of his personal private fortune over the last few years defeating Proposition 8 in California. Or was he for, was Proposition 8 against gay marriage or...
Prop 8 was against gay marriage.
Okay, so he was promoting Prop 8.
So he was supporting it.
He was supporting it. And, you know, he lives in North Carolina.
Right.
So, you know, the point being what? And thank God that gets defeated. We're now in post-DOPA territory. And then Scott goes and in interviews just about a week, 2 weeks ago, compared Obama to Hitler. Now, not everybody, including good progressive lefties here at WBAI loves Obama. But really? Hitler?
That's really quite stopped? A leap.
It really is. So, you know, I don't think that his statements are going to hurt Ender's Game, the movie. I think they're going to hurt the likelihood of their making a movie out of my favorite book, Speaker for the Dead.
And that would be a shame.
It really would be. Because I think that's the best book in the series. I really do. I thought there was some real insight there. When I went online in like 1980, 81, and I went to CompuServe, one of the first people I met online, there was a science fiction writer named Michael Banks, but there was also somebody welcoming people to the world of online called Uncle Orson.
Oh, yes.
And he gets it. You know, he gets the idea. If you read Speaker for the Dead, I dare say that Scott invented the concept of blogging 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I'd agree with that. There's a bit of that in Ender's Game already, I think.
It touches upon it. Yeah, but I mean, really, whatever Ender's name is in Speaker for the Dead, I don't recall, he uses a handle.
Yes.
And he has his, let's call it a tablet, and he writes stuff, and instantaneously, people all over, as what Joss Whedon would call the known verse, are seeing it, responding to it, writing back, and it's a blog, gang.
It really was an amazingly prescient vision of what the internet would turn out to be.
Yeah, yeah. So it was amazing. You're a pretty early internet developer, aren't you?
I first started doing internet development in 95. Got my first website in 95, as a matter of fact.
The web became open to the public in 95.
Mm-hmm.
August, it's almost something like near Hiroshima Day. It's something like August 9th or something like that.
Yeah.
It was between like Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Oh, right.
Sorry, anniversary, stick with us here.
Yeah.
And, but that's when the web was taken away from the National Science Foundation and .com. The one part of the internet that would almost never be used became almost the totality.
Yes.
As it were.
Yeah.
Yeah, and at the same time, I got ourwolf.com.
Ah.
Before that, I was at magpie.com.
Oh. Well, that was prescient as well, you getting that domain name.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, yeah. I knew it. I mean, for God's sake, Paul Wunder, who's a movie critic here, I bought him movies.com.
Oh, my word.
I registered movies.com.
Wow.
And after a while, he just said, I prefer, you know, like Paul Wunder Screening Room or something. And he just let movies.com, he sold it to somebody for like $1,000.
Oh, my word.
He paid like, you know, $100 for it. And so $1,000 10 times, hey, that's great.
That's a pretty good return.
Paul!
Could have been a lot bigger.
Even then, like 97 or so?
Yeah.
Even then, it was probably worth, 50?
I'd imagine, if not more.
Yeah, I mean, and what would somebody pay for it today? I worked for internet.com for a while.
Wow.
And that doesn't, nobody's using it. It's just sitting there saying, you know, this domain name for sale, ante up. You know, and the owner of it, which is, when I was working there, was Meckler Publishing, which had EarthWeb and various things. And actually, we had a bunch of websites called internet.com, and I was an editor. I was networking and Linux editor. I know about networking, no bupkis about Linux, but I knew the people because they were all out of the science fiction world.
Right. Science fiction and the internet have gone hand in hand since as long as there's been an internet.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, so, internet web anyway.
Yeah, internet? But before that, there was a lot of science fiction forums on places like Genie and CompuServe.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I ran the CompuServe there. Thank you. I had the power to offer any science fiction writer a free account on CompuServe. I was a whiz-op there.
Mm.
And everybody was on Genie, and which was General Electric.
Yeah.
Or the Source. And it's like, their interface sucks. We have an okay interface. We even have a graphic user interface that you can use for CompuServe that ran on DOS.
Oh, yeah.
That was called, like GCIS, Graphic CompuServe Information Service, something really intuitive like that. But CompuServe was just so much better, and Mike Banks was at the Source. Remember the Source?
You know, I don't remember the Source.
It was owned by Reader's Digest.
Oh.
And despite that, they were actually pretty good. They're pretty good online service. But all the Skiffy people went to Genie.
We all were.
Yeah, yeah, for no particular reason.
I think they just had a critical mass, and that's where people went to because that's where everyone else was.
Yeah, and also science fiction people in those days were Luddites. They didn't know how to use their bleeping computers. They really didn't.
Well, and using Genie looked pretty much like playing a text-based adventure game.
Oh, no, it was harder than that. That's CompuServe. You know, go forum. You know, kill dwarf. Kind of thing. Let's talk about Bill Shun. William Shun is the proper. When I see your name in a magazine, it's usually William.
It's usually William.
Yeah. Tell us about your writing, and what are you working on?
Well, what I did for the last 6 years in Chicago was write a little bit of short fiction and really work on two books very hard. One of them is the memoir we were talking about a little while ago.
Yeah.
I've done
Accidental Terrorist. Yes. Great
did
title.
Thank you. Did a couple more drafts of that and got that even more submission ready than it was. And my agent is shopping that book around as we speak. And the other novel, or the other book I worked on, is a novel, a young adult science fiction novel.
Mm-hmm. Called, which is a good market now.
Let's hope so. And that's called Root, and that's out being shopped around at the moment as well.
R-O-O-T?
R-O-O-T.
Okay.
Yes.
It's a homonym, you know.
Yes, it is. It is. But specifically, Root being, I don't want to give any spoilers, but Root, in this instance, refers to the top level super user on a computer network.
Okay. Yes. Like somebody roots their smartphone.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know if that term is used in Apple. It's used in Android. That to get underneath the OS, you root the phone. I will not do it because I value the security of my phone.
And right.
It's like opening the back door and say, okay, everybody, pile on
in. Come on in.
Yeah.
Everybody's welcome.
Yeah. And they do it. They do it. They'll go, you root your phone, and then, you know, well, I have an extra.
You'll be rooted and pillaged.
Yeah, exactly. Well put. I just had this idea. I have an old phone. I should do that. It's a phone I don't use. It's my original Droid.
Oh, yeah. Root it, and that can be a good sandbox.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I have my Nexus 3 here and my Nexus 7. Old Nexus 7 as opposed to the new Nexus 7. And I will be upgrading before the end of the year to a newer phone. I haven't decided yet what. It will be Android. But
lovely. The Android world is something of a black box to me. I've been an iPhone user from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Out of inertia at this point,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. I've just, you know, the elegance of the iPhone is impossible to gainsay. It's really just a beautiful piece of engineering.
That it is.
It really is. But it's sort of like... But it's their engineering and their world. And, yeah, I agree. Android is more of a sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good... And I like to play in the sandbox.
Sure.
And I think that's a good comparison between the two. I will not say one is superior to the other. I just prefer the world to which I am used, and I also like what I dislike. Get into religious discussion here. I dislike that Google. Once upon a time, Google was like, here's one cool thing after another, after another, after another. They had their little thing for health. They had Google Notebook. That was wonderful. iGoogle is great. It's going away soon. All these things that Eric Schmidt put out. And then Eric Schmidt was like bumped upstairs. And Larry Page, one of the founders of Google, took over. And thus begins the Google One universe, where everything is being like tied in together. My Picasa web photos, all the pictures for Hour of the Wolf and the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series and all of that were in Picasa. Now, all of a sudden, they're on Google Plus. I didn't ask for that. I got migrated.
Right.
I got migrated.
Right.
And I don't appreciate that. And as a tech support person, I support a lot of tech illiterate people.
Hmm.
And all they want is a portal. All they want is one page that they can go to. There's the weather. There's the news. There's a tab for all their publishing information.
Right.
Some of these are literary agents. And, you know, so here's a page for this client. Here's a page for that client. Tab, tab, tab. And that's it. And their world is a happy world. I Google. Zip.
Wow.
In a matter of months. Why?
That's a good question.
They're sunsetting. I'm wiggling my fingers. They're sunsetting these things. And it's all because they're trying to. Now, this is ridiculous. Why not make iGoogle your personal homepage in Google Plus?
That seems like it would make too much sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're not here to talk about this stuff. I'm sorry, Bill.
That's all right.
I just love gabbing. And with you.
Yeah. And, I mean, we have all those techie things in common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because I remember being at not a party. It was like a small get-together of, like, six people at Paul Witkover's house. And there was a song, and Barbara and I each had our shiny new droids at that moment, and we're saying, what's that song? And Bill and Laura both look at each other at the same time, go, oh, I got this. And they both went and launched
Shazam,
yes. Which I've now taken off my phone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, the capabilities are built into Android.
Ah.
All you have to do is say to Android, what song is playing? And it does the same thing.
Interesting. I wonder what Siri would say to that. That's something I haven't played around with much with my new iPhone 5.
Yeah.
I haven't done much with Siri.
Siri is way cool. And it's the Android capabilities are as good but different. What Siri has that the Android can do some more. And now with Android 4.3, it can open your apps and do all that good stuff. What the Android stuff lacks is, and David Pogue pointed this out, and I think he's right, personality. Siri has a personality.
A personality?
It really does. It's clever. It's funny. I don't think it's quite as functional. But the idea that you have this relationship with it is exquisite.
Yeah.
So which one is better? Depends on your mood.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. One isn't better than the... Oh, but there is one difference. I just don't care for Apple's policies. Its worldview.
Hmm. The way that its store is locked down.
It's more than that. It's the litigation.
Yeah.
The constant litigation, the patent trolling, which every company now does, the nonstop lawsuits, the shutting down of companies that do Apple repair without paying the fee, that in order to get something into the App Store, you have to pay to have it put in.
Right.
Is it any safer? No, it isn't. They've had as many break-ins as Android. And on Macintoshes, they're just wide open.
Mm-hmm.
I know too many people who don't put virus protection on their Mac because they were told by people, it doesn't need any.
Yeah, and it's those viruses are starting to show up.
Yeah, because as a one writer I know called it no radio on board syndrome. Nobody was writing viruses for the Mac because you're going to write for the 85% or for the 7%.
Yeah.
So you go after Microsoft, and you can't get into Linux. Linux is secure, but you can't use it. It's no front end.
Yeah.
No user interface. And then Apple, just nobody was there. And then all of a sudden, people discover that they've got a, now I'm forgetting the word, a zombie virus.
Oh, yeah.
Where your computer is pinging a particular address in order to shut that down, and your computer is one of millions doing it.
Right. Ropes you into a denial of service attack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you don't know, what's going on,
right,
because it doesn't take away from your computing capability.
Right.
But you're part of the attack. And because people didn't have antivirus protection.
Right.
There are good free antivirus programs for the Mac, everybody. Get one. I'm not saying don't get a Mac. I'm saying
but if you get it, protect it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, so
we were talking about things I've been up to.
Yeah, because, I mean, you see, the problem is also we haven't seen each other until tonight,
right,
after
There's,
X many years.
Yes.
So we're doing just a lot of catching up, and we're doing it on the air.
Exactly, and when I showed up at the KGB reading series earlier this evening, I had no idea I was going to end up here at this time.
I didn't say hello, Bill. I didn't say welcome back to New York. I turned. Eugene Myers was tentatively scheduled to be here tonight and couldn't do it, and I knew that from earlier today. And I turned around, and there was Bill. I just looked at him and said, "You know, you're on the air at 1:30, right? This isn't a question." Later on, I made it a question. I mean, you know.
Sure. Give me a chance to wriggle out of it. But no, I'm always happy to be on the show.
Because there are future dates. Yeah, well,
yeah.
And we're going to keep that up. And we'll have to set up a reading for you also.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out the pairing. And also, you have actually subbed for me.
Yes.
On occasion.
Yes.
At least one occasion where I was just too sick to run the damn thing.
Yeah.
And Terrence Taylor can do it. Now, so can you. Actually, now I've got Terrence reading in October for our vampire reading. And Kate Locke and Margot Adler will host.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So it'll be an all vampire evening.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be fun. Terrence has worked for CTW and PBS.
Ah.
And it'll be an interesting thing to do, like, you know, a... Henson workers or a, you know, all Muppet
Sesame Associates.
Sesame Associates Skiffy reading.
Yeah, that would be fun. I'm on board.
Yeah, yeah. We'll figure out something. We'll figure out a good pairing. We're not doing an LDS number. We're just not. There's you and Brandon Sanderson, and there's nobody else I would have that I'm aware of.
There are some other Mormons or ex-Mormons kicking around, but none of them are coming to my head at the moment.
Yeah, and there's no need for it.
Right.
An anthology might be an interesting idea.
That could be. Or people with other interesting religions in their background, because Carl Schrader is an ex-Mennonite.
That's right. I actually had him on the show.
Oh, yeah.
He won... one year, the Writers of the Future Award. And I got a phone call from somebody in California from Galaxy Press. And I thought, oh, Galaxy Press. I used to work for Galaxy Magazine. Galaxy Press, they must have bought the name. And they did write the name. What I didn't realize is that Galaxy Press was a part of Bridge Publications.
Uh-huh.
And that Bridge Publications is, of course, LRH.
Exactly.
L. Ron Hubbard, only if it were only as benign as Hubbard was, which he wasn't. Talk about a dark cult, but that's another story.
That is.
I just recommend to people, read Going Clear.
This
actually... Not, what are you doing, Lister? Jesus. The people around here, the door's open. He's on at 3. But he always shows up early, and it's nice to have... Our studio audience has arrived.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so that's good. So, Lister, this is Bill. Bill, this is Lister.
Pretty sure we've met before. Yeah.
Could very well be.
I think so.
Could very well be.
Yeah.
So,
yes. Down in Wall Street area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Would have been. So you see, you have been on since you moved to. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I have to go back and look through
because
my
I've only been in this time slot with Lister following me for almost 3 years now.
Okay.
Just shy of 3 years. So, there we go.
Right.
So there was a time when you came to New York, possibly even a CIFWA weekend.
Well, that explains why I can't remember it.
Well, yes. Yes, because they serve good.
Yeah, they do.
Beverages.
They do.
At those do. Things, yes.
But, you know, having me sub for you at the NERSIF readings on those occasions... prepped me pretty well for something I was doing in Chicago.
Talk about that.
I didn't start. I took over an existing reading series in Chicago about 3 years ago. The name of the series is Tuesday Funk, and it happens...
That's F-U-N-K.
Exactly. It's perfectly...
You dirty listeners, you.
Perfectly fine to say on the radio. It takes place at a bar on the north side of Chicago called Hop Leaf. We get the upstairs room. And
is that near Clark Street?
It is on Clark
Street. Oh, my God. I mean, I've been in Chicago like 3 times in my life. I do not know Chicago. And I know this place.
Well, it's legendary.
I didn't go in there, but one of my first days in Chicago, I discovered Chicago, like New York, is a great walking city.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked Clark Street south to north.
Oh, my word. That's a long walk.
It's about 9 miles.
Yeah. Yeah, and Hop Leaf is towards on the north end of that walk, not all the way north, but yeah.
Yeah, I took a rest at Division Street.
Ah,
you know, which is a bit of a ways.
Yeah,
I had lunch at Due's.
Hmm.
There was Uno's
Pizzeria Due. Yeah.
There's the guy who owned and sold Uno's opened up a restaurant called Due's. You know, and that, you know, makes perfect sense. If ever he sells that, I guess it'll have Trio or something.
Oh, yeah.
Or Tray.
Tray?
Tray.
I don't...
Pizza Tray. Something like that.
Pizza Tray sounds like something that you carry the pizza on.
Well, there you go. Except they use skillets.
Yes.
They use cast iron skillets there. Yeah.
They do. And the pizza at Pizzeria Due, I think, is quite a bit better than in the chain version of Uno's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is what the original Uno's was, which is what made it so special. Although I have to admit, I shouldn't say this, but, you know, I like Uno's. I think their pizza's quite good. I like Chicago-style pizza. But I like New York pizza, so...
Yes. I'm glad to be back for the pizza.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm continuing to host Tuesday Funk. For the next several months, I'll be traveling back to Chicago every month to host until we. I
mean, there's no Bolt bus. That's not easy.
No, it's not. It's not. But I do live close to LaGuardia now, so it's at least an easy hop to the airport on this end.
Yeah, I know. I know whereabouts you are. I used to live in Jackson Heights. I could walk to LaGuardia. It's under a mile from where I grew up. And for a while, I was my office was actually in Cambridge, and every Friday, I would have to go to my office. Otherwise, I was working online because this was part of CompuServe,
right?
Ziffnet, which was a part of CompuServe.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And but the offices, I was the only New Yorker for Ziffnet. Everybody else was in Cambridge, so right near MIT. Duh. And we were working with some guy named Tim Berners-Lee.
Whoever he is.
Now, it's amazing. I bet nobody actually knows who he is. Really. It's
People probably don't.
They really don't.
But probably a lot of the people listening do, though.
I wonder about that.
I don't know.
I wonder about that. if there were, you know, if I think that the Time magazine did name a man of the second half of the 20th century, which could have been a woman or a machine or something. And I don't remember who they did name, but it should have been Tim Berners-Lee. And you don't know who Tim Berners-Lee is, right, Lester? Yeah. Yeah, Tim Berners-Lee invented the web. One person did this. It was not a committee. It was not a group. There was no democracy about it. He developed one guy did it. He developed the HTTP protocol. He based it on SuperCard, which was a Macintosh program. There was HyperCard, but that was very limited. SuperCard could actually do links. And he created a browser called Mosaic with other... he didn't create Mosaic. He created Lynx.
Right, Lynx. The...
L-Y-N-X.
That was the command line browser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's good enough. What more do you need than command line? And Gopher and Veronica and Archie. and he invented the World Wide Web. One guy.
He changed the world.
Yeah. But I could walk to the airport. And take Delta shuttle.
The shuttle.
I took
the
Delta
shuttle. Marine Air Terminal.
Yeah, exactly. And you paid on board the plane. Can you imagine?
Cannot imagine that.
Yeah,
these
yes,
days.
Youngsters, when I used to. So you're still going to. So are you?
I'm still going. I mean, we still have.
Now this wasn't strictly science fiction.
No. As a matter of fact. From the beginning, Tuesday Funk tried to incorporate different genres and even different types of writing. There are essayists, poets.
A lot of poetry, I believe.
Fiction writers, writers of mainstream and genre fiction. We try to have a real mix. And we've had some reasonably big names over the last couple of years. Alex Shakar, who won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for fiction last year for his novel Luminarium.
Yeah, which I actually read.
That's a really good novel.
Yeah.
A good 9/11 novel, even.
Yeah.
Coming up, our next installment of Tuesday Funk is September 3rd, and I'm going to be reading.
Oh, okay.
We'll also have a New Yorker poet named Virginia Conchin. And we're going to have Alexander Hemmon, who is a MacArthur fellow. And he's published a lot of fiction that's been very acclaimed. But a collection of his essays, sort of a memoir/essay collection called The Book of My Lives, came out this year to incredible acclaim. He's part of that little group that includes Juno Diaz, Colin McCann.
Minor folk like that.
Yeah. His name comes up in that.
Juno Diaz, if you listen to this radio station, I want to interview you. I want to meet you.
I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I want you to read in my series. But anyway.
Yeah. So I usually try to include a speculative fiction writer of some kind on every program.
Uh-huh.
And then in October... That's the September show. October 1st, we're sort of spotlighting an anthology called Glitter and Mayhem.
I've got October 1st is a Nursef reading.
Because
we're usually first Tuesdays.
Yeah.
And so are you.
So are
Damn
we.
Damn it. The reason I'm not doing first Tuesday is too close to Worldcon.
Yes. Well,
I'm September 10th.
The interesting thing is there's a Glitter and Mayhem party that's going to happen at Worldcon that I'm really sorry I'm missing. But this is a cool anthology. I wrote a story for it with my wife.
Ah!
This is the first time we've collaborated. And
On fiction.
On fiction, yes. Yeah, say no more. The anthology is a collection of short stories... Speculative short stories that take place in the roller disco or nightclub worlds of the 70s and 80s.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to have a couple people from that anthology read.
You need roller derby people for that. You really do. It's...
Oh, yeah.
No, well, there's still roller derby. I think that the Gotham girls or something.
There are.
Like
my
that
wife used to be a Gotham girl.
What?
She used to skate.
Yeah. Oh, I am sorry I missed that.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that was a few years ago when the league was just starting up. But yeah. Yeah. And in fact,
I can see it. I can see Laura.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. She
in
was
my
tough.
Imagination doing that. Yeah, yeah.
Her derby name was Delia Payne.
Oh, deal with it. Yeah.
But there's actually going to be a launch party for that anthology at Worldcon at a place in San Antonio called the Rollercade.
Oh.
Yeah, and I'm very sorry I'm going to miss that. That's
well,
gonna
you're going to have to do another one, you know, at a New York roller derby because they have them here. So
yeah.
Have your own, yeah. For God's sake.
Let's you know. Do one here.
You know, do a satellite.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, first Tuesday. So we're actually in competition, New York to Chicago.
New York versus Chicago.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So I won't be around for most Nursif readings until the end of the year, but I'll transition to the new co-host. And be back in New York on the first Tuesdays.
And consider something. No. You have to move to another. We can't have readings opposite each other.
No, we won't. But I'll be around
after
to
transfer.
Yeah. But I'll be around to come to the Nursif readings.
Oh yes,
anyway.
Absolutely, and perhaps be a Nursif reader again.
Love to.
It's been a while.
Love to. It's been a very long time.
Yeah. So yeah, because
although I have read for Nursif since moving to Chicago. There's one Amy Goldschlager curated that one.
That's right.
And I flew in just for that, filled in at the last minute. Paul Witkover read also.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. And Amy put that one together, and I did the door.
Yep.
I did the door. Which reminds me, I have to get Amy. Amy, I know you're not listening. I have to get Amy to do the, or Terrence Taylor to do the door for September 10th, because Barbara won't be around. So,
well, at least I'll be able to come to that one.
Yeah. And that's Michael Swanwick and Rick Bowes.
That's going to be great.
Yeah, I mean,
a couple of the best short story writers out there.
Yeah. But I just realized that when you said October 1st, it's like ew.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm going to do two in October.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I have to accommodate. There's two people coming to New York, Moira Krohn and Roger Kamenetz. Roger does not write science fiction. He wrote a book called The Jew and the Lotus about Hasidic rabbis meeting the Dalai Lama. It's a real event that he brokered.
Oh, interesting.
And there's a documentary about it that was on PBS. And he's, you know, and he writes poetry and stuff like that. And, you know, shortlisted for Pulitzers and stuff like that. So somebody says to me, well, he doesn't write science fiction. Deal with it. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, I don't care.
Why should
But his
you?
Wife does. She was a Philip K. Dick shortlist.
Very nice.
This year. For the Not Yet, really, really good New Orleans speculative fiction novel that came out about the same time as Beasts of the Southern Wild. So a great year last year for New Orleans-based science fiction. And listeners, if you haven't seen Beasts of the Southern Wild, I think it was one of the best spec fic movies of last year.
I've not seen it yet, but it's in my queue.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's in the queue.
Yep.
High up
in the queue.
Yeah, in the N queue. How long is your reading going to be for this morning? Since I've
probably 20 minutes, maybe a little bit more.
Okay, and it's already 2:23. Yeah. And the next show is sitting in the rooms.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
So we should probably get started. Okay. Do you want to take a music break? Before, or do you want to just dive in?
Either one. I can just dive in. It's fine. Either way. How about some music?
Yeah, let's do some music. One of my usuals, or do you have a request?
I have a request, actually. I thought of a request. And it's short, brief. East St. Louis Toodaloo by Steely Dan.
Wait, they did?
They did.
I know Ellington.
Of course.
But, okay, it helps if I can, you know, spell it. East, S-T should do.
Yes.
U-ist, T-O-O-D-L-E.
Where?
Hyphen O-O, I assume.
Yes, exactly.
And Steely. No, it's not Steel Eye Span, listeners.
Yes, listeners will know that Steel Eye Span is probably a little more common on this show than Steely Dan.
Yeah, okay. So, from the album Pretzel Logic, here comes East St. Louis Toodaloo. No, there's no Ivy Anderson in there. I do miss hearing Ivy Anderson, but I gotta say, for an update of the Duke, that'll do until he's reborn. And no, Mercedes Ellington doesn't count.
Yeah, those guys did have a lot of reverence for Duke Ellington.
Yeah, they had a lot of reverence for music, period.
Yeah.
But Ellington, as far as I'm concerned, is, I think, classical. That era is classical music. It's not jazz. Or a blending.
Sure.
It's Ellington. It's a genre. He was a genre.
Yes.
Anyway, this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City and WBAI.org. And my name is Jim Freund. With me is William Shun. And I've been wasting his airtime just chatting away, but you're going to read for us.
I am.
Lister, would you do me a favor? Would you turn off that fan and close the door?
Read
it. During readings,
right.
We try to make this room a little more silent. And we can close the door as long as I know Lister's in here so he doesn't get locked out. So, anyhow.
I'm going to read a chapter from my unpublished novel, Root, which I've finished recently. I was mentioning earlier. It's a young adult science fiction novel. Kind of looks like a fantasy novel. And In the first chapter, our heroine, Hasta Vera Machineni, who is a 15-year-old Indian-American girl living on the north side of Chicago, has seen various strange goings-on happening at her school and has then gotten into an argument with her teacher and another student in computer science class and been sent to detention. Detention was in Mr. Clements' history classroom. His stupid rule was that you could only do your homework using reference books from his room or the school library. No other resources allowed, online or off. And the freaky thing was, he always seemed to know when you cheated. But thankfully, he wasn't there yet. Hasta took a seat in the corner of the chilly classroom farthest from the door. She pulled her Einstein sweatshirt out of her backpack and slipped it on over her head. She had the classroom to herself until Jillian slunk in and plopped down in the first desk she came to. The girl glared at Hasta from that ugly blue pancake makeuped face. "Thanks a lot, Scud," she said. "Screw you," Hasta said, turning back to the window. "You didn't have to chime in." It was hard to believe they'd ever been friends. Hasta tried to let the scene outside calm her down. Huge elm trees towered over the school's grassy front lawn and fading flower beds. The patterns of sunlight and shadow that ruffled their green and orange canopies reminded her of the shifting patterns of the game of life. The way each individual leaf flipped from light to dark and back seemed random, yet she could almost glimpse a system at work behind the overall pattern. A spray of leaves shuddered loose from one bough and drifted up. Straight up. Hasta blinked. "That's weird," she thought. But when she looked again, the leaves were halfway to the ground and still fluttering downward, her eyes and mind playing tricks on her again. Heels clicked loudly on tile. "Let me not waste your time, ladies," Principal Armistead said, striding through the door and pulling it shut behind her. Jillian barely glanced up from the yellow legal pad she was writing on, but Hasta sat up straight. What was this? She thought Mr. Clement was supposed to be running detention. The principal stopped in front of a map of the Asian war zones. "Miss Smart, please pay attention," she said, snapping her fingers. Jillian sullenly looked up. "Your detention assignment is to write me a paper at least 500 words in length. Choose an ancient culture and describe how they believed the world would end." Jillian groaned and put her head down on her desk. Hasta swallowed her annoyance and nodded intently. She'd gotten herself into this mess. Getting through it was all she needed to think about. She could do this. Principal Armistead swept her arm in a broad arc that took in Mr. Clement's many creaky bookshelves filled with moldy old tomes. Her burgundy polyester pantsuit shimmered in the slanting afternoon sunlight. "You may consult any volume in the room, of course. And since this is my assignment, you may feel free to do your research electronically. But I don't want you emailing or texting. Oh, and one more thing." Her violet eyes narrowed at each girl in turn. Her gaze made Hasta feel like a frog on the dissection table. "I don't have to tell you how rare disciplinary problems are here at Amundsen High. One student in detention is remarkable enough, but since I have two today, I'd like to try something a little different. I want to see you collaborate. I want your joint paper at the end of the hour." "What?" Hasta protested. She felt like she'd been punched in the stomach. She pointed at Jillian, who was snickering ruefully and shaking her head. "You can't really expect us to work together." Principal Armistead had turned to leave. One hand rested on the doorknob. "I can expect it, and I do," she said, looking back. "You disrupted poor Miss Deckard's class together this afternoon, so I find it only fair that you make up for it together here now. Do well on this assignment, and I can consider writing off your detention, which would mean it stays out of your permanent record." The principal gave Hasta another sharp look before exiting. "I want your joint paper at the end of the hour," Jillian said in a mocking voice. She rolled up a narrow strip ripped from the top of her legal pad and held it to her lips. "I got your joint paper right here." Hasta sighed. It was going to be a long hour. "I can't believe she's leaving us in here together without supervision." "You think she's not watching?" Jillian said. "Set one foot out the hatch. See how fast she treks." "Treks?" Jillian rolled her eyes. "Shows up out of nowhere?" "Oh, how does she know?" "What do I look like? Einstein, Jillian said, pointing at Hosta's sweatshirt. She just knows. She went back to writing on her pad. Her black backpack sat on the floor beside her. Hosta looked around the classroom but couldn't spot any hidden cameras. She ended up staring longingly out the window at the cloudless sky. The daytime weather index for Chicago was a perfect 67 degrees, but that would only hold until 5 o'clock. She hated wasting any of this beautiful October weather. She wanted to be outside, not stuck here doing make-work with a certified juvenile delinquent. But she had no choice in the matter. Gritting her teeth, she gathered up her backpack and moved to the desk next to Jillian's on the opposite side of the room. She would have preferred to stay by the open windows, but someone was going to have to take the lead here. Jillian hunkered protectively over her legal pad. "Pardon me," she said, glaring at Hosta. "You heard Armistead. We have to work together." "No way," Jillian said. "I'm not writing any dopey paper, not with you. I got my own biz to tend to." Hosta leaned into the aisle, trying to read over Jillian's arm. "What is that?" "Party invitation," Jillian said with a sullen sneer. Her bloodshot eyes drilled Hosta. "Don't worry, you're on the roll." "The roll? Like, invited?" "That's what I said." Hosta sat back, surprised. "Are you serious?" "As a cardiac arrest." Jillian bent back to her task, pen in hand. A party invitation from Jillian Smart was the last thing Hosta expected, and probably not something she wanted to accept. No doubt they were way into drift. "Well, cool, I guess," Hosta said. "But we still need to get this done. I don't know about you, but I can't afford another black mark." Jillian snorted a laugh. Blood heated Hosta's cheeks. "Was that funny?" Putting down her pen, Jillian turned a cold smile on Hosta. "What cracks me up is that you think it matters." "It totally matters." Hosta bounced in her seat, trying to keep a rein on her temper. "You may not care about getting into college, but I do." Jillian smirked. "Oh, right. Because I forgot the rules don't apply to you." "Of course the rules apply to me," Hosta said, though it felt a little like a lie. "Not as much as the need for attention." Hosta's anger flared. "I need attention. I'm not the one walking around with my face painted blue. What's that about?" Jillian's lips compressed. "Just trying to blend in with the enemy," she muttered. Hosta put her palms flat on her desk and took a deep breath. "Look," she said, eyes on her hands, "all we have to do is write one stupid little paper and we're out of here. I'll do the work. I've already got an ancient civilization in mind. All you need to do is a little Googling to make it look good in case they're watching our net usage. What do you say?" Jillian sniffled, picked up her pen again, and bent deliberately over her legal pad. She didn't look at Hosta. "Don't make this harder than it needs to be," she said quietly. "What do you mean? I'm trying to make it easier." Jillian heaved a weary sigh. "Screw this," she said. "Listen, Scud, do me a favor. Just leave me alone. And whatever goes down next, stay chill. Don't freak out on me." With her right forefinger, Jillian traced a clockwise circle on the back of her left wrist. Then she slumped a little and didn't move. Startled, Hosta reached out and shook her shoulder. "Jillian?" Jillian slid down farther in her seat, and her head tipped sideways toward her shoulder. Her eyes and mouth hung open. That plus the blue makeup made her look like more like a corpse than ever. "Jillian!" Hosta only realized she'd stood up and backed away when she bumped with a clatter into another desk. She felt strangely queasy. What was happening? A seizure? An overdose? Was it a practical joke? "If you're just kidding around, Jillian, you better tell me now," Hosta said. "I'm serious." Saliva leaked out the corner of Jillian's mouth. She still didn't move, although she did appear to be breathing. Heart pounding, Hosta ran to the classroom door and out into the long hall. From what Jillian had said, she expected to find Principal Armistead lurking right there, but there was no one in sight. "Hey, anybody?" she shouted. No answer. Hosta peeked back into the classroom. Jillian sat sprawled at her desk as inertly as ever. Hosta could go hunting for Principal Armistead or one of the teachers, but she wasn't sure it was a good idea to leave Jillian alone. Time to call 911. As she pulled her cell phone out and dialed with shaking fingers, she thought she sensed someone smoking nearby. She didn't smell anything but couldn't shake the impression of burning cigarettes. She put the phone to her ear. "Emergency dispatch," said a woman's voice. "What is the nature of your emergency?" "Hey, what are you doing?" Jillian demanded, sitting up straight in her chair and blinking. Startled and relieved, Hosta turned her back on Jillian. "Sorry, I think I butt-dialed," she said, with one hand curled around her mouth. She broke the connection. Jillian wiped the spit from her mouth. "What, were you calling an ambulance or something?" "I thought you were dying," Hosta said, all her anger churning up as she rounded on the girl. Jillian rolled her head around as if she were working a kink out of her neck. "Freak," she said. "Didn't I say stay chill?" Hosta turned her phone off, worried 911 might call her back. "You didn't say you were about to go into a coma. A little heads up would have been nice." "Whatever," said Jillian. She glanced at the clock on the wall. She looked miserable. "Tend your own biz, okay?" She traced another little circle on her wrist. "What is that, some kind of self-hypnosis trick?" Hosta asked. But Jillian had already slumped over again. Hosta made a frustrated sound. The queasy feeling was back. She clomped over to the desk next to Jillian's, making as much noise as she could to retrieve her backpack. Jillian didn't so much as stir. Sitting again in the farthest corner, Hosta pulled out her netbook and tried to concentrate on the assignment. It was hard because, weirded out, she kept looking at Jillian's insensate form. Forget her. Given her family's faith, Hosta figured it would be easiest to write about the ancient Hindus. She wasn't a believer herself, but she'd been exposed to the philosophies and the myths her whole life. The Hindu Holy Trinity comprised Brahma the creator, Vishnu the preserver, and Shiva the destroyer, though each had endless other functions and attributes that overlapped in confusing ways. According to some traditions, the world ended every time Brahma went to sleep and was reborn each time he woke up. According to others, the world was instead a dream of Vishnu's that would end when he awoke. Hosta typed up a page of notes, checking Wikipedia two or three times, in an attempt just to untangle all the variant stories. "Should have picked Ragnarok instead," Hosta said to herself after 20 minutes of trying to put together a clear line of explanation. The end of the world in Norse mythology, as she'd learned from Thor comics, was a simple, clear-cut battle between good and evil. She decided to focus on the different ways of looking at the cycle of destruction and rebirth in Hindu myth. She typed furiously, interrupted every few minutes by Jillian waking up and putting herself back to sleep. Jillian wondered if whole worlds arose and passed away in... Hosta wondered if whole worlds arose and passed away in Jillian's head each time this happened. About 40 minutes in, a big orange cat leapt up onto the windowsill and rubbed its fur against the glass. Hosta shivered, watching it. She couldn't remember the last time she'd seen a cat. When it jumped down again, she went to the window, but couldn't spot it outside. A couple of minutes before the end of the hour, Jillian woke up and stayed up. "How's our paper coming?" she asked, yawning and stretching. "Shut up," Hosta said. "I'm almost done." "Testy little scud," said Jillian. Hosta tuned her out. "In the end," she typed, chewing her lower lip, "the only thing Hindu mythology promises us with any certainty is that our imperfect world will be given chance after chance to redeem itself, to get right the things that went wrong the last time around. With a message like that, no wonder it's still around 5,000 years later." She had just hit save when Principal Armistead walked back into the room. "It's time to turn in your work, ladies," the principal said, holding the door open. She looked back and forth between the two distant desks. "You did work together, am I correct?" Jillian was stuffing her legal pad into her black shoulder bag. "No doubt," she said. Principal Armistead frowned. "Email me your paper, and you're both free to go." As Hosta sent the document, Jillian bolted for the door. She ducked under the principal's arm and made her getaway. "Slow down, Miss Smart," Principal Armistead called over her shoulder. "Remember our talk about patience." Hosta stuffed her netbook into her backpack. She lowered her head and tried to slip past Principal Armistead the way Jillian had, but one polyester-encased arm slid down to block her path. Not so fast, Miss Vera Macchineni. Hosta pointed into the hallway. Why does she get to leave? Because you're still on the cusp, and I still have hope for you. The cusp of what? The principal didn't answer that. Her violet eyes drilled through Hosta. Can you give me your assurance that you and Miss Smart really did work together on that paper? Yes, Hosta said, squirming. It was hard not to look away. Are you sure? Yes, she protested, glancing at the empty hallway. She did the research. I did the writing. Principal Armistead sighed. She laid a cold hand on Hosta's shoulder. Hosta tried not to shy away, but the touch made her uncomfortable. You're a smart young lady, but you'll make a lot of trouble for yourself in this world until you learn to think before you speak. That goes for asking questions and answering them alike. Now, I'm afraid I must fail you on your assignment today. What? Hosta demanded. But the assignment's done. No, it isn't. I know you didn't work together, and that was the assignment. Hosta shrugged the principal's hand off her shoulder, seething. This was so unfair. There was no way she could have passed, not when Jillian wouldn't cooperate. Her nostrils flared. She may as well not even have tried. Principal Armistead smiled in what was probably meant to be a reassuring way, but it only made her look hungry. Why the sour expression? She said, standing back from the door. So you earned one failing grade in detention. It's hardly the end of the world. Hosta stormed out of the room, eager to get away before she said something that would get her in even more trouble. Her father was going to kill her as it was. The long hallway was empty except for Mr. Costner, the elderly white janitor, who was pushing a squeaky mop bucket her way. He began to raise his hand in greeting. But then the world froze. Between one step and the next, she found she couldn't move. Lamb raised his head. "Did you feel that?" he signed. Kneeling across from him, his partner Cray nodded. "The end. It has begun." "Once again," Lamb signed, "at last." He and Cray rose to their feet as one. The glass box was barely tall enough to let his partner stand up straight. Cray, like Lamb himself, wore a rumpled dark suit beneath a colorless trench coat and fedora, though in the taller demon's clothes, Lamb would have looked like a child playing dress-up. Indeed, even when kneeling, Cray was taller than Lamb at his full height. Lamb looked down through the thick glass to the street far below. 1,353 feet below, to be precise. He felt nothing but a mild curiosity. The people to his left, those who for this moment waited frozen, silent, and unaware on the 103rd floor observation deck of the Willis Tower, found it thrilling, even exhilarating, to stand in this spot. To Lamb, except for the view, it was much like standing anywhere else. Perhaps the thrill required human mortality in order to be experienced properly. "The end does render our inquiry here moot," Cray said. His hands sketched the words efficiently, without a wasted motion. Lamb nodded, looking up at his partner. They were investigating a report that this northmost of the four glass boxes on the side of the tower was periodically shifting to the 102nd floor. But if the end had finally begun, again, then addressing this particular problem became a low priority indeed. "Shall we proceed to the north side?" he asked. "That would seem prudent," Cray said. "Any impediments to a clean end will most likely be centered in the neighborhoods around Amundsen High School." Again, as one, Lamb and Cray turned and stepped from the box back into the building proper. By the time they reached the elevators, the discontinuity had ended and the people around them had resumed milling about and murmuring as if nothing had happened. And for them, nothing had. The elevator doors opened immediately. No one else stepped aboard with Lamb and Cray. On the quick ride down, Lamb contemplated the prospect of the end. It sparked no great excitement in him. The end had come before, how many thousands of times he did not recall, and the end would come again. He expected the process would be orderly, but might there be glitches like the ones Adele McLeod and Brand Banks had presented? He hoped not. At the same time, though, he noted that tracking them down and wiping their brains had been the most interesting thing to happen in this current cycle. The elevator deposited them at ground level. No one paid them any mind as they crossed the lobby, exited into bright autumn sunlight, and walked to their car. The battered brown sedan was parked in front of a fire hydrant, but of course no one had interfered with it. Cray drove them north with Lamb riding shotgun. To uphold physical law, to preserve and defend the natural order of things, that was their mission. And now, to ensure that the world would end smoothly and without incident. Shiva help whomever stood in their way.
You've been listening to a section from the unpublished novel Root, read for you by the author, William Shun.
Here come the priests, each one wailing and bemoaning, Lordy, they got their heads bowed down. Here come the madmen, they're too excited for atoning. Burn the mosque, they're shouting, burn it down. Save me a place, surround me with friendly faces. All of us have gathered here to share.
Now, far be it from me to ever want to interrupt Carly Simon in anything that Carly Simon can do, especially this song, which is, I think, my favorite of hers. But I neglected to put on the weekly movie review that we have done for us by Dan Persons, which appropriately is Kick-Ass 2. It's a good segue, don't you think, Bill?
I like to think so, yes.
So we're going to play that now, and then we'll just barely have time to, well, share the end after. So, hold on, let me do that, and then this, and, there we go, and take it away, Dan.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Michael O'Donohue once said, sophomoric is the liberal code word for funny. That's not always true. Sometimes sophomoric is just sophomoric, no funny involved. That's one of the many problems with Kick-Ass 2, the sequel no one asked for to the film that wasn't all that good to begin with. You may have noticed that my reviews for Hour of the Wolf have gotten longer these past couple of weeks. That's because we had films worth devoting the time to. No such problem here. Kick-Ass 2 is just not good, and that's that. So, just for the morbidly curious, here are the dirty details. The film is a hybridization of two standard superhero sequel plotlines. In one, nerdy teen superhero Kick-Ass, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, joins forces with a team of similar citizen superheroes, inspired by his own shining example, and headed up by Colonel Stars and Stripes, a badass, played by Jim Carrey in a surprisingly engaging performance. Kick-Ass also gets a new nemesis in the form of his old fighting partner, the mob brat Red Mist, played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse. Garbed in his deceased mother's bondage gear and, to up the queasy factor, redubbed with a name the FCC would prefer me not to use. Let's just say it's a very recognizable street term for the character's Oedipal issues and a suitable representation of the kind of ham-fisted, quote-unquote, edgy humor director Jeff Wadlow brings to the proceedings. As for Hit Girl, the previously barely pubescent crime fighter who in the original Kick-Ass garnered the most controversy both for her R-rated dialogue and for being a prime source of some of the movie's more explicit violence, never really bothered me. It's a movie, folks. And who is once again played by Chloe Grace Moretz here. She gets involved in a poorly motivated superhero hangs up her cape subplot that somehow veers into Heather's territory, made all the more weird by the fact that she's now supposed to be 15 years old, but the script still treats her as 13. That story gets wrapped up eventually, but not before Hit Girl uses a machine to make the head Heather simultaneously puke and soil her pants, thus situating Kick-Ass 2 somewhere between Disney Channel Slapstick and Troma Studios. Look, this is a sad, pointless film. There's a pretty good running gag about that standard furnishing of all supervillain lairs, the Shark Tank. John Leguizamo delivers the film's other good performance, and there's a nicely staged fight scene in a moving van. Otherwise, you'd have as enriching an experience staring at the wall for 2 hours as you would watching Kick-Ass 2. It's an inept, adult-aimed satire that doesn't so much deconstruct the nature of comic book reality as it does the whole point of financially motivated sequels. I'm Dan Persons. Discover more about the world of fantastic film and TV over at Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
So I guess the message that we're taking away from this is don't bother. That would be my review of Kick-Ass 2. Don't bother. I am interested, though, despite the fact that it'll probably have a bit of gore and stuff in the new Simon Pegg film, which is another apocalyptic.
Yeah, and it's the third entry in Edgar Wright's Cornetto trilogy.
Yes, Cornetto appears in all three movies.
Yes.
And I've still never seen Shaun of the Dead. What? It's in my queue.
It is gory, but it's also funny and extremely well constructed.
Yeah, I like Edgar Wright films, but I just don't care for gore. You know? And I know Dan says it's just a movie, folks, but it isn't. It's what I'm watching. It hits my retina, and I can have nightmares months after because that's burned into my brain.
Makes sense.
And that, I'm not saying people shouldn't do that, but that's who I am. And as a result, this is not a film I'm going to go see. But not that I was going to see that particular one. Anyway, Shaun of the Dead, I'm going to get around to because I just like their work too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And I once saw an ultra-gory movie, Robert Rodriguez film, help me.
Oh,
George Clooney, Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, From Dusk Till Dawn.
From Dusk Till Dawn.
That's a wretched movie.
I loved it. It's a horrible film. I thought it was hilarious.
I guess it all depends on the expectations you bring.
Yeah, I brought total dread.
Yeah,
the film, and I ended up going, "Oh my God, this is clever."
And I had high expectations, and wasn't happy when the twist to vampire film.
So yeah,
film
that's
happened.
Exactly yeah. that. So that's exactly yeah. it. A question of what you bring to
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And speaking of what to bring to it, I'm afraid we're out of time. Our outro theme music has already quietly in the background begun. So people should all go to shun.net, shunn.net.
Correct. You can find lots of videos and blog entries and stories and lots of things there.
Podcasts.
Yes.
So y'all should do that. Bill is now back in New York, and you'll be hearing more from him. And thank you, Bill, for being here.
Thanks for having me. It was great to come back.
Yeah. Stay tuned, everybody, for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister. And in the meantime, take good care. We will be back next week from 1:30 to 3:00. Have a good week. Take care.